You're doing all the things so that you can look back and go like, well, I could never have done that 2 years ago. And now I can say to my manager that there was a triggering event in the last meeting and I'd like to discuss it. I could never do that before.
Welcome to Designed to Be Conversation, presented by Designed to Be and hosted by Designed to Be founder and CEO, me, Rachel Weissman. Designed to Be is a community for designers to grow their emotional intelligence. In this show, I have conversations with design leaders about how investing in their EQ has impacted their design career. In today's episode, I speak with Jeff Veen. Jeff is a design partner and head of platform at True Ventures, where he spends his time helping founders create better products. He does this as an advisor, as well as for companies like About.me, Medium, and WordPress. Previously, Jeff was VP of Design at Adobe after they acquired Typekit, the company he co-founded and ran as CEO. Jeff was also one of the founding partners of the user experience consulting group Adaptive Path, where there he led MeasureMap, which was acquired by Google. During his time at Google, Jeff designed Google Analytics and led the UX team for Google's apps. Much earlier, Jeff was part of the founding team at Wired Magazine, where he helped build Hotwired, WebMonkey, Wired News, and many other sites. During that time, he authored two books, Hotwired Style and The Art and Science of Web Design. We dive into ways in which trust is established at work and how it's necessary in order for people to be as creative and successful as possible. Welcome, Jeff, to the show.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you're so welcome. So when we were chatting a bit a few weeks ago now about, okay, what under the umbrella of emotional intelligence do we dive into? You shared this very long email with me that I was so gracious to receive that gave a lot more color into where your head currently is at. Thus, as a result, we've landed on this intersection of topics of trust, culture, and innovation. One, I'd love for you to provide folks a bit more color of how we landed there, and then we can actually really dive into the topic.
Sure. Let's see. Trust leading to culture, leading to innovation. It was when we were starting Typekit. That was in 2008 or 2009. And if you can like remember all the way back then, that was just a few years after the iPhone came out, after Apple really sort of changed the whole mobile landscape and all of that. And a lot of people attributed this success of the iPhone to this thing called design. And they were like, design is the way that like Steve Jobs changed everything, and that's why they're making billions and billions of dollars. And that was kind of in the air back then. And, you know, for me, it was like, oh, everybody realized what we realized 15 years ago when we first started the web, and like, whatever, that's fine. I'm glad it's here now. And everybody was talking about design as this competitive advantage. And I realized, well, if everybody believes that, then this secret that we've had where good design leads to better products and that are more profitable and have less risk associated with them, if that's the case, then what is going to be a competitive advantage against all of those companies that are now embracing design? And I kind of came to the conclusion that all the teams that I had worked on before, the ones where we were the most successful were the ones where we felt safe with each other, where there was trust, right? There were many times, many jobs that I had had in the past where I didn't feel safe and I didn't do very good work, and the products that resulted didn't do very well. And so I thought, all right, so we'll do that. Like, what can we do with this team we're putting together at Typekit to increase trust, to build a culture where people feel safe, so that we could be our most creative and everybody could bring their sort of bring their most creative self to the table so that we could have that as a competitive advantage. We could move faster. We could see things that other people weren't seeing. And we could make a product that we felt would have a lot less risk in the market. And that's where it really started to come from. And then we worked on a bunch of stuff to try to figure out how to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. As you were talking, it was giving me a lot of flashbacks of some safe environments I've worked in and some some not so safe environments.
Right.
And how that it affects your ability to create and innovate and think of new ideas and feel comfortable collaborating. And the list goes on.
Yeah, yeah. And the simplest possible way to put that is imagine you're sitting in a meeting with 10 people and you're looking at the product, let's just say. That's what this meeting is about. And you have an idea and you have to do the calculation in your head. If I say this idea, what are the consequences? Right? If I say this out loud, is there going to be a turf war? Is somebody going to be offended? Is everybody going to think I'm stupid? Right? Like to get a team, let's say to get those 10 or 12 people sitting around the table, all to just say everything, right? to create an environment where you know you can say it. And if it comes out wrong, somebody will just like ask you for a little clarification or whatever. But there's no consequence, right? To let's get the ideas out, more ideas, more ideas. Yeah. And if there is consequence, if something happens, that there is somebody at that meeting that can say like, hey, we don't do that like that. Like, let's bring this back and let's create that safe space. Let's maintain it. And that to me was like, oh my God, that's every part of our business has to be focused on creating that space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The framing that you just shared, it's actually a loss of time. Which is fascinating. Okay, I want to dive a bit deeper a little bit to ground folks of, okay, so we're starting to talk about trust. And if you could turn back the clock and think of possibly the first working relationship that you had where you had a deep sense of trust between you and that person, what about this person made you trust them?
Interesting. That's a great question. There are two that I can think of,
Let's go both.
Yeah, let's do them both because there's a really interesting contrast. The first one that comes to mind is my first proper job in design. I had gotten hired just doing production work at Wired magazine way back in the 90s. I was shocked, like, oh my God, this is exactly where I want to be, and everything is happening right now. It was at the beginning of the web. And what happened when I got there is the creative director for all the digital stuff that Wired would eventually be doing, she learned that I knew HTML. and there were, you know, there was 100 people in the world that knew HTML in 1994, I think. So I was, you know, she was like, you move your desk into my office and we're going to design this thing and you're going to tell me what I can't do and build stuff and I'll just keep, and we'll just iterate that way. And I, you know, that turned into a 4 or 5 year relationship of working together, but started as an apprenticeship and something that I try to get young designers to think about. Like, could you find a way to get yourself in a position where you're like, you're doing all the mundane rote work for somebody far ahead of you, right? Mm-hmm. And if you can, again, like balance this relationship such that they are deeply appreciative of what you're doing and teaching you everything. Like it's better than any college degree or any course you could possibly take. Like that is where I learned everything. And I learned everything about how to sell design and how to manage stakeholders. Like I just learned so much in that relationship while I'm just cranking out day after day, more and more and more and more HTML, for this thing we were building. And it was just, I think the trust there came from such complementing abilities, what I knew and what she knew. And this just high level of respect which is something interesting from a mentorship perspective. Like if you're farther along in your career and you want to mentor somebody or you want to bring somebody up in the industry, like thinking about your respect for them, rather, right? Like the other way seems obvious, like, oh my God, you've done so much and I'm just starting. I have so much respect for what you do, but turning that around. So she had a lot, I felt really respected in that relationship. I thought that was really remarkable. So that's kind of the beginning of my career and the like a different power dynamic relationship. After that 5 or 6 years, started a company, a design agency, and met the person who turned out to be just my BFF, right? Like we still work together 22 years later now. And that was one of those, I don't know, like it sounds super pretentious to say like a, you know, a Lennon McCartney thing, but like, oh, we share half of our brains with each other. And so it just works. And that was just, I think, understanding chemistry. Like, you know, oh, everything's so much easier when the two of us are doing this together. And, you know, so he ran the business of the agency and I did more of the creative work and it was that. And we still today, he was the co-founder of Typekit as well. Like, so we have worked all along, all together. And he sort of owned the business model and the operations of the company and the finances. And I made the product and got the, you know, the development team and design and everything and that. And it was just this, you know, amazing partnership as equals, always as equals, even though I had done more in my career when I met him. I'm like, I don't care. The equity is the same, you know, that kind of, we're going to do this as equals. Cause then, then there's no question to motivations, I think is the way to put it. But huge, huge levels of trust there.
Yeah. I want to mirror back a little bit what you said and touch on a few points because a couple of things came up on my end. One, the respect piece is I resonate so deeply with that. And to your point, usually you think about the respect from the very junior person to right. I really respect this person and whatever that may be.
Yeah.
But it's vital that it goes both ways. And I think that very much also relates to what you were alluding to in terms of the chemistry with other people. Something that a concept I've really been noodling and marinating on as of late is this idea of false connection and wanting to connect with people who don't truly respect you or don't truly value you due to your own insecurities or your own limiting beliefs or what it may be. And I think what was so beautiful about your story of you and your BFF was that you found someone, you're like, oh yeah, we really do jive. And it is hard to balance sometimes with certain people of, okay, yeah, me and this person, and I'm socially aware of how we can balance and I'm removing my ego of, even though I did this work, we're going to split this 50-50 and we're just going to go.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of beauty around that story as well, that you alluded to, through connection and being aware and,
It's interesting because if you take that coin and flip it over and look at the dark side of it, right?
To mix
a metaphor, I guess.
Yeah.
Some of the regrets I have in my career are around generally like being, for lack of a better word, required to work with somebody. Like, you two go do that, you know, in the times where I didn't have as much control over my destiny and responsibilities and stuff like that. You two go figure that out. Not being able to find that chemistry at all, not being able to feel respect in either direction, and then kind of just ghosting away. Like, this is not
it's working. Scary. It's scary.
It is.
And it's easier to retract than put yourself out there and be vulnerable.
Right. And almost all the good that has come in my career and life has come from some part of adversity. you know? Yeah. Not that I can't, not that I'm not enormously grateful for all the privilege that I've experienced, but those bits of adversity of, this is really hard, you know, it's, mm-hmm. it's that trope, like I'm so much stronger now, so much better.
Yeah.
So I wonder about all of those relationships where I'm like, you know, the question is, are these good boundaries for me to have, or have I missed opportunity of really pushing through and finding something that I would not have anticipated? I don't know what the answer to that is, but like ghosting kind of sucks.
Yeah, it's not so fun. It's not so fun. Yeah, there's a lot of things we could touch on there, but I want to unreel us back in a little with trust and for the designer who's listening, who's like, okay, Jeff, there is a couple people on my team who I feel really connected with, and I think my manager respects me. I don't know, but I think. But there's other people on my team that I just started joining this new project, and there's these new stakeholders. What would you say to them who are curious to develop more trust between these new people that they're starting to work with?
Right. That's good. The difficult answer for the designer on the team trying to find trust that I always start with is that it so much depends on leadership, which is not an empowering answer, unless you want to be a leader, so go do it. Like, but you know what I mean? Like creating, like if you're in a meeting where you're getting yelled at and nobody steps up for you, right? Nobody stops it. If a peer is yelling at you, then you're in a position of like, what do I do here? Like, this is okay behavior, you know? Yeah. And that's a bit of an extreme example, but, it is around the norms of the group. And one thing I, even when I, you know, when I'm not in a position of leadership, but in a group that has to work together, is being the one that's like, can we talk about norms a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. or going to your one-on-one with your manager and saying, hey, in the meetings, this doesn't quite feel right to me. And is that okay that we do this? That, you know, somebody can shout me down, or that somebody can just interrupt me and take my idea, or whatever it is, whatever has happened. But I think having a vocabulary around that, even at the beginning of your career, is incredibly helpful, because then you can identify the thing that's causing you not to feel safe, and articulate that. And that's, you know, that's a pretty advanced life skill for most people, I think, to be able to, you know.
Very, very much.
So if you can do that, and if you can't do it with your manager, that's like, that's just such a huge red flag, mm-hmm. right? So that's part of it. No, I think that's all of it. Sorry.
Yeah, no, you're good. I one other piece that I want to touch on, that is part of the story that you just shared, was, yes, it's noting what aligns and doesn't align with your values, what feels right, what doesn't feel right. And then also by you feeling comfortable to say something to, whether it be your manager or another coworker, by sharing that thing and pulling that person aside, whether it be virtually or in person, and sharing that something that is a little bit more personal, whatever on that scale that feels right, the person receiving that is like, oh, they feel comfortable sharing that with me. And upon sharing whatever that may be, I've also found that that is a way that forms trust as well.
Yeah, for sure. There's a great process called issues clearing. Mm. And if you search for it in Google, you'll find a bunch of different takes on it. But the interesting part about it is a process for like, hey, I got a thing that I got to work out with you. And here's 7 steps that the two of us can go through to get there, right? And if everybody on the team is familiar with this process, you could say, I have an issues clearing thing, you know? And like all the difficult emotions of stepping into conflict kind of start to dissolve if everybody knows the process already, right? And the process is great because it is a super detailed exercise in active listening on both sides. So imagine taking that into design critique, right? Like, we're going to put the work up there, and we all have a process now for how we're going to talk about that work and how we're going to talk to each other if there's disagreement. And that's just, like, you do that, and those meetings change. Like, I, in the middle of my career, I was at Google for a little while, and I went to those infamous design reviews, product reviews, and they were brutal, right? Because that was an engineering organization, and they were making billions of dollars by being the best computer scientists in the world. And a designer would come and show this, you know, this thing that they had been working on without consulting stakeholders, because there was no process for that. And these engineers would just tear it apart. Yeah. Just, you know, because what was valued there was analytical competence. That was the only, right? That was the highest value. So let me prove that I'm smarter than you. And it just, you know, and it's went on and on and on. And I was like, oh my God. And I came from that to start Typekit, right? So I was like, well, that's not going to happen, because I felt like crap in those meetings. Like, it was horrible. So so there's a bunch of process. You could do things like issues clearing. You can have a great, like we used to call it postmortems. I think they're more incident reviews or whatever now, but whenever we had a problem with the product and we had outage or some big bug or something like that, we had this really well-defined process that everybody knew about already for identifying the root causes and not identifying the root person, right? Like, mm-hmm. We'd look for the causes, and somebody would say like, oh, that was me. And like, well, you were obviously aren't trying to bring the site down. So what were the circumstances that led that to happen? Oh, we're not doing this enough or whatever. And so then people felt free to share everything that had happened in a situation where there was a bad outcome, because they knew they wouldn't turn into criminals, right? That we would work to find out to make sure nobody else was able to do whatever had happened again. So there's a lot of different techniques you can do like that. So again, we keep coming back to, I feel like I can be as creative as possible here. Mm.
There's, as you're talking, there are so many different pieces, but kind of to start to draw a through line of what we're talking about. And you started to touch on this a bit. The relationship between trust and culture. I feel like a lot of the stories that you already started to share was how, okay, in by bringing these values that are clearly under the table, above the table, into clear dialogue, whether it be retrospectively, and we're talking about it now, or ideally, maybe whoever is listening, once they take off their headphones, they can have a more intentional conversation about how are decisions being made and how are what's valued in the way that people are relating. But I'm curious, what's this bridge between trust and culture?
Well, right. Culture, you can say that culture is a collection of articulated values, right? Or I should take articulated out, because you're going to have a culture no matter what. And if you don't articulate the values, they're still going to be there. You're just not going to be as intentional about it, I guess. Mm-hmm. But it is defining what all of those values really are. What do we as a team, as a company, value? For example, at Typekit, we really value the craft of design. Because all of our customers are going to be designers, like, it has to be very intentional. So, you know, when I was interviewing engineers, that was right up front, you know, like, that's something we're going to probe for to see if you're a cultural fit, like, mm-hmm. And things like that. And that also gets back to your earlier question about what does a designer earlier in their career do to you know, around these values. That can be your whole set of questions for when you're interviewing for a job, right? Mm-hmm. Like, not what am I going to work on, not even who am I going to work with, but exactly what you said, like, how are decisions made here, right? How do you decide what goes into the product? Who decides? What's the process like? What would my involvement in that process be? You know, those are amazing questions to really understand. when you're trying to evaluate if this is the right place for me or not.
We are going to take a short break to hear an exciting update from Design to Be. Design to Be is thrilled to bring back the Design to Be training with our Spring 22 cohort. With 8 weeks of emotional intelligence training, community, and meditation, we provide you the tools, skills, and mindsets to increase your impact and find meaning in your work. If you're looking for a new job, you're starting a new role or project, or you're seeking a meaningful career, the Design to Be training is for you. Upon completing our program, you'll join our global alumni network who design the world's most used products and services. Some that you're familiar with include Bumble, Coursera, Dropbox, Google, Instacart, Pinterest, Uber, and Zendesk. We are fusing authentic community, inspirational speakers, and actionable techniques to uplevel your design career. Curious to learn more? Head to designtobe.com/training to learn more and apply. Applications are now open and close on March 29th. But designers will be accepted on a rolling basis, so be sure to apply early to secure your spot. Now, back to the show.
There's a shadow side that I want to make sure that we touch upon of when thinking about culture and values of, okay, you're a right fit. And I think in a lot of ways, talking about our identities and how that plays into that. So I was curious from your perspective, what the role of intentional diversity plays into creating this trusting culture.
Yeah, well, that's like if you double click on what I was saying about ghosting and like, you know, like I can't seem to work with this person. Am I missing an opportunity or not? If you drill down into that, it ends up with how intentional can we be with increasing the diversity of the team? So first of all, I think there's a lot of consensus now and a lot of data proving that teams that are made up of individuals who have less overlap in their backgrounds, maybe even in their values, certainly in the way in which they identify and all the various ways they identify. If there's less overlap, there are therefore like more people from different backgrounds, the products do better. And the teams, if they're intentional, can function at a much higher level mm-hmm. because there isn't the assumption of the thing that I'm going to that I'm going to fight for in this discussion, everybody else believes, right? Like that's not, and that was, I think, probably my, maybe even the biggest regret, but certainly our shortcoming as a team with Typekit when we were building it, is that everybody was the same, honestly, right? Like we did not have ethnic and gender diversity. It was just all dudes. It's one of the things that I had been talking about on my podcast when I was doing it, about how this big cultural backlash has happened against technology because it feels like every part of our lives is being designed by a bunch of white dudes in Silicon Valley. And like their experience is very different from the experience of everybody else in the world. And the products show it all the time. Even though I have all this background in user-centered design and user research, the product for Typekit I designed for people like me. We're, you know, designers that knew a little bit of code and on the front end and knew their way around CSS and things like that. Like that's our audience. And so we didn't have to do a ton of research because, you know, and then we hired a bunch of people that also were like that. And there we go, made the product. Very myopic product, a successful but myopic product that did that. And in retrospect, being much more intentional with different viewpoints would have probably made a much better product That has certainly certainly played out in the work that we did at Adobe, for example, and things like that. It's a little bit like that old trope of for you to really, really be sure that you understand something, you should teach it to somebody else. Right? Like you've probably heard, like, go give a presentation and you'll realize, like, oh my God, I'm doing a lot of shortcuts in my head when I think I really understand this topic. Mm-hmm. And so if you can pair that with, like, oh, this thing that I think everybody else believes and I certainly believe, like, let's just do that. If you take that into a meeting where nobody else believes it and you have to defend it, and pair that with that level of trust, I feel safe here. These people are different than me, but I feel completely safe being able to say whatever, then that's even next level in the culture.
Mm-hmm. And it bridges a lot of the last piece of this stool that we're creating, of innovation. And a lot of what you shared, I deeply resonate with on so many levels, and upon just starting the building blocks of getting things together for design to be, creating a culture and intentionally bringing diverse folks in, whether it be guest speakers for this podcast or guest speakers for the training, or people who are part of the training or who are just in the community itself, really expanding out of how can we connect with folks who might be identify in different ways or globally. But there's also this shared sense of, ooh, this is really interesting. And okay, yeah, I want to share this. And a lot of what you started to allude to is that it leads to greater innovation. So I wonder if you could share an example of maybe it's where you currently are at True, or possibly at Adobe, or another point in your career where working in either a diverse team or a team that really trusted each other and having that really trusting culture, and how that shifted the way you all created something impactful. Hmm.
Well, I can say that it's very interesting to be, you know, a designer by trade, in the role of venture capital. Like, that's, I think, unique and relatively rare. I think I know all the ones who are. Like, you know, there's not very many of us that are doing that. But I think that could be, like, the most data-rich example of this idea of, you take all the principles that I was talking about around better design teams, better product teams, better products, diversity in the team, and trust and safety. Take all of that and apply it to the most raw version of capitalism, like right there, like the very beginning of the process. Not all the stuff that gets into Wall Street and all of that, but I mean, I have an idea. I have nothing to show for it. Give me some money to go try. Right? Like, that's super intoxicating, to be perfectly honest. Like, I love that part of it. I've been on the other side of it as an entrepreneur, and so, you know, being able to be involved at that stage over and over again, and that's what True Ventures does. We're at the very earliest stages of investing, and the hypothesis then is that you take those principles and you apply it to one of the biggest power differential relationships you can imagine, which is investor and founder, right? Like, at the very earliest stages, I have nothing, I have no money, just an idea, and you have access and capital and all of that stuff. And you apply, like, can we develop the trust relationship there? The hypothesis is more innovation, less risk, more creativity, right? Less concern over the possibility of failure by building it on the kind of the pillars of emotional intelligence. And we see that with our companies all the time. If we can, like, develop the relationship between the investor and founder that's built on that, so that the founders can then model it with the teams that they build. Mm-hmm. If you, like, you inject the DNA right at the very beginning, not like, oh, we're 50 people now, we should have a culture. Like, that's right. And all the same things. Oh, like, we're 50 people, we should hire some women. Like, come on. You know, like, that was a conversation for the very, very beginning. Mm-hmm. Across all those things, we value design, we value psychological safety, all of that stuff at the very beginning. And maybe even, let's do a user-centered process to figure out what the product should really be to get us closer to product market fit sooner before we run out of money. So I'm not sure I really answered your question, but that's that was my decision-making also when I ended up at True Ventures because they were the lead investor in Typekit very, very early on in the formation of that company. We were very fortunate in that we had multiple term sheets from multiple investors, and we chose True's, even though it wasn't the best the winning financial terms. But I remember turning to my co-founder, my BFF, and saying, like, I just feel safer with them. Mm. You know, one of the big fears in the entrepreneurial world is, like, I'm going to lose my company. Like, I'm, you know, I will not hit the numbers that the investors to fire me as CEO. They have that ability. And, like, that's a terrible place to be. And it's very isolating and huge, full of anxiety, not a very creative environment. So I could say, like, I really feel safe with them. And they have this community of founders that, you know, are going through the same stuff. So we'll have some community around us. So anyway, I do think there's a lot to that. Like, the pillars of emotional intelligence as an investing strategy is really, really interesting.
What you said is so powerful. And I just want folks to, like, marinate in that a little of, I feel safe with them. And so many people, maybe folks listening, you don't feel safe in your role. And it's quite an uncomfortable place, to be in. And even as I'm talking, like, my palms are getting sweaty thinking about some times that are not so comfy.
Yeah.
So two questions for the person that's listening that is like, okay, I think I kind of feel safe. And, like, we're doing good work, but I think it could be better. What are things that they could do? And for someone who it's clearly, like, not so much of a safe space, how would you recommend for them to develop the courage in whatever way to make a shift?
You know, a lot of these are going to be conversations that feel like they will have conflict in them, right? And so I think really learning how to step into those conversations is that life skill that's going to, like, pay dividends forever. And I think that's the answer to almost all of these, right? And so, you know, like, cognitive behavioral therapy has a lot to say about what happens when there's emotional triggers and what we can do around that and how we can practice and get better and learn skills. Mm-hmm. To me, that was, you know, unfortunately, it was sort of the middle of my career, not the beginning of my career, when I realized, oh, all of those are skills. They are skills like learning to use Photoshop that you can, like, read about and understand and talk to people about and then practice and do it over and over again. And a lot of the things that you're afraid of, you can chip away at that fear over time, and you can look back because you're journaling or whatever, right? Like, you're doing all the things so that you can look back and go, like, oh, I could never have done that 2 years ago. And now I can say to my manager that, there was a triggering event in the last meeting and I'd like to discuss it. I could never do that before. And I had learned all about, you know, layers in Photoshop, and I can play piano now. Like, they're all skills, and you can get much, much better at them. But almost all of them, the way to feel safe is to step into the conflict. And then, you know, use everything that you can to, you know, label the emotions as you're feeling them with the person that you're talking to, things like that. But I just think the more you can invest in yourself in getting better at that, the earlier in your career or any time in your career, really, the better off you're going to be.
Yeah. Yeah. So much of what, of what you just shared, resonates so deeply of reasons why I've started Design to Be. I do think there is also, there are these turning points in people's career of, yes, maybe you're early on in your career, maybe you've just switched to a new job, maybe you're just starting a new project. And there are these like transition moments that allow greater space for reconsideration. And while, of course, each and every day, like a normal Wednesday that you've been on the same project for a year, of course, yes, you could take a moment. But I think there's also starting something like net new.
Yeah.
Also allows to have this greater conversation of, okay, how do I want to build this relationship of deeper trust? What kind of culture do I want to create on this project with my PM, this project with a fellow designer, a project with someone who I've never worked with before. And how could that lead to something that's even better than I could even imagine?
Yeah. And we are, you know, recording this at a period of time, like with unprecedented migration that in their career, that people are experiencing in their careers, as one of the sort of net results of the crazy 2 years of pandemic, like everybody is reevaluating, like, oh, all the circumstances are now shuffled and I can perhaps, you know, find a new place that is more aligned with my values. And I think that's a conversation a lot of people are having with themselves or their partners or whatever. Like it's really remarkable.
Yeah. So many people. So I want to shift to a couple closing questions. So we've dabbled on a handful of different topics today. So from trust and culture and innovation and intentional diversity. And you touched a bit on this of emotional intelligence. And all of these topics that we've spoken of today falls under this umbrella of emotional intelligence. So I'm curious from your perspective, why is this an important skill for designers to invest in?
You could probably take the word designers out of that sentence or the question, and it would apply to anybody.
Humans. Yeah.
Humans, yeah. But I think designers in particular, like if we have a conversation about ethics in product design, I think, you know, or ethics in business even, people often like look at the designers. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that designers are more successful when they're more in tune with empathy, right? Because for design to succeed, it has to solve real human needs. And to solve for human needs, you have to understand those needs, even when they're not yours. So that's like design is this engine of empathy. This means that if you take the fundamentals of emotional intelligence and lay them on the skills required for designers to be successful, there's a really good match. Mm-hmm. So conversely, getting better at emotional intelligence and we haven't even talked about ego, and that's a big huge one as well. But if you get better at those things, you will be a better designer. And it's interesting, like I think joking about Photoshop, but like tools is like 4% of what you need to know, right? Everything else is about all of the input that goes into what you do with the tool for that little bit of time, right? Mm-hmm. Especially as you move up in your career and you use the tools less and less and less, and you realize that perhaps the best way to be a leader of a team is by stepping out of ego, but even doing, you know, going to design review and or showing up at a crit with your work and leaving the ego behind to just show the stuff and say, here's five things I tried. Give me everything, right? All the feedback I can. So like it just all of it, I think, is really aligned with our profession.
Yeah. It's bringing more awareness into your relationship to what you do rather than just the output. It can be something that you're more aware of what you're experiencing throughout the process and can express that, and is a removal of the ego. So you feel confident of like, yeah, I'm going to put myself up. And people aren't just going to like rip it to shreds because they're actually good. There's a good intent of this team. And right. I know that they're supporting me. And instead of, I guess I'll put it up and I'll pray.
I started my career in journalism. I was a writer just for the first few years before the web really started taking off and became a career path. And it was journalism. And I mean, like, I had an editor who drank scotch at 11 a.m. And like, we could, and here's the thing that'll blow your mind, kids. We smoked at our desks. Like, it was journalism. This is a long time ago. And I remember, God, like 19 years old, you know, 20 years old, I got a job at a newspaper while I was in college. And I turned in a story and like on paper, and the editor looked at it and said, hold on, this is shit. Do it over. Like, that was my first feedback. Do it over. Mm. And I was like, you know, yeah, it was so, and that's not to say like I got calloused and then it didn't matter. It was like, no, it was like feeling that emotion, mm-hmm. you know, over and over again made me understand it rather than learn to repress it. So I agree with you. It doesn't have to be that. You don't, right? Like, we don't do creative work like, you know, a newspaper did 30 years ago. We do it very, very differently now. And I think it works way better. And we just have to cultivate that mm-hmm. in ourselves and in our teams and with each other, you know?
And folks listening are definitely making that first step by listening to this very episode. one final question for you. If you could ask one thing of folks listening as it relates to trust, culture, innovation, anything that we really spoke of today, maybe something they could get started on once they take out their headphones, what would it be?
I would identify the difficult conversation you're avoiding right now. Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily going to tell you to go have it. Just identify it. Like, I find myself, you know, ruminating all the time about, like, I shouldn't, but without consciously, like, rationally, like, what is going on with that? And maybe, you know, how about just go do a, like, 20 minutes of writing on something you're going to throw away about that conversation that you're not having. And even start with that. And then, for the advanced listeners, I think all of my advice boils down to get a therapist. It's just like, learn the skills. And that's a therapy for, it's like having a personal trainer at the gym. Like, make sure you're doing it right. That's all, right? There's plenty of work you can do on trauma and mental illness and stuff like that. And you can also have somebody who's on your side and is a coach and a safe place to argue all this stuff out and learn the skills.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff, for your insight and your passion. I loved your energy. I learned a lot today, and I'm sure that folks listening did as well. So thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it. It's a lot of fun.
That wraps up another episode of Designed to Be Conversation. Thanks so much for listening. If you're curious for more ways to invest in your EQ to be a more empowered, educated, and effective designer, head over to designedtobe.com. That is designtobe.com. You can take our design process EQ quiz or sign up for a newsletter to receive the latest Design to Be community building, live offerings, and self-inquiry guidance directly to your inbox. If you enjoyed this episode, we invite you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere you may listen. Be sure to share this podcast with a fellow designer who's interested in investing in their EQ. And again, thanks so much for listening.